It's Wednesday, December 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, German authorities search for the driver of a deadly truck attack.
Strong relations will continue. No one has the strength to destroy the relationship between the two countries.
The investigation of a Russian ambassador's assassination continues. Also ahead, smog clouds China's future. Healthcare is again a topic for U.S. lawmakers. And letters for Santa. It's all on today's International Edition. The German Interior Minister says there is no doubt a truck attack Monday in Berlin was intentional. German police released their only suspect as they continue to seek the person responsible for driving a large, stolen truck through a crowded Christmas market, killing 12 people. The chief federal prosecutor's office says it released the man, a Pakistani national, because it did not have enough evidence to charge him with a crime. The attacker fled the scene, and police captured the Pakistani man about 2 kilometers away. He denied any involvement. The head of Germany's Federal Criminal Police Force said police have not yet found the gun believed to have been used to kill the truck's driver before it was stolen. Chancellor Angela Merkel visited the market site and said it would be especially hard for us all to bear if someone who sought protection and asylum was responsible. VOA's chief European correspondent Luis Ramirez has more details, which he shared with International Edition host Ira Melman.
The Berlin police are calling on the public to be alert. That's because they believe that the person who caught this attack at the Christmas market there in Berlin may still be on the loose and may still carry out more attacks. And so as the day has gone on, more gruesome details have come out on just how it happened. The first victim of this truck attack was the driver of the original driver of the truck itself. The truck appears to have been, according to police, commandeered. The driver was a Polish national who was delivering steel to Berlin when the truck apparently was hijacked. The man's body was found in the cab of the truck. He had been shot and stabbed. GPS records from the truck's owner show that the truck was carrying out some pretty unusual moves, is how they described it. And so it's very much an open investigation with the search ongoing for who police believe will be the true suspect. Other questions emerging at this point. One of the casualties of this incident may be the political career of Chancellor Angela Merkel, who is already facing big questions from her opponents about her migrant policy. Germany, in the last year, took in 890,000 asylum seekers, and that has deeply polarized German society.
And what has she? We know what she has said so far, that it would be especially hard for us to bear if someone who sought protection and asylum was responsible. What are others saying around Germany now about that controversial situation?
Well, let's start with some of her political allies who, in Bavaria, as a matter of fact, on Tuesday, called on her to reform and tighten Germany's immigration policy. Now, this is coming from the people who support her. A few months after her party lost her home state. So she's clearly got some questions to answer. Incidentally, she has said that she will run for a fourth term. This incident certainly raises questions on whether she will be successful. Now, on the other side of the aisle, her opponents, of course, are seizing on this incident to renew their call for her to change again Germany's immigration policy, to tighten it further. She has taken some steps in recent weeks to try to allay concerns that she might be just a little too open to immigration, especially from Muslim countries. One of the things she did is announce she's backing the ban on burqas in public places in Germany, similar to what France has in place. And there was also a symbolic gesture made by her defense minister, who refused to wear a veil when she met with Saudis recently. All this intended to send a message on behalf of those Germans who believe that the values of Islam are not compatible with, in many cases, with German society. What her critics are saying is that these gestures were perhaps too little, too late, and there are calls for her to step down on the part of her opponents.
VOA Chief European Correspondent Luis Ramirez. Return to the social media world now, and two American celebrities are getting a lot of attention for different reasons. Our own social media celebrity, Michael Lippin, is here to explain. And besides yourself, Michael, who's the first celebrity you're going to tell us about?
Oh, man, Jim, I am no celebrity, but the first one I'm going to talk about is an American pop singer who had his heyday in the 1980s, Richard Marx. He's perhaps best known for his ballads, but on Tuesday he made a new name for himself as something of a hero on a Korean Air flight from Hanoi to Seoul. What happened is that a man on the flight became violent, assaulting female members of the crew, and Richard Marx joined other passengers in subduing the assailant. Marx was on the flight along with his wife, Daisy Fuentes, who's a Cuban-born TV host and model with 136,000 followers on Instagram. So can you guess what she did? Well, she posted a series of photos of that confrontation on her Instagram feed, along with this note: "This incident went on for 4 hours. I feel horrible for the abuse the staff had to endure, but no one was prepared for this. They never fully got control of that violent passenger." That post got lots of people commenting. One Instagrammer wrote this to Fuentes: "Your husband is very brave, the perfect man, you're a lucky girl." Marx himself posted a couple of photos of the incident on his Twitter account, as well as a note saying that he has video of what he called the entire chaotic and dangerous event. There's no word on whether he will release that video, but his heroics made him a top Facebook trend today. And to be fair to Korean Air, there was no reaction from them on their Facebook or Twitter accounts to this incident when I last checked.
Okay, I guess that's not going to be a music video.
No.
Who's the other celebrity in the spotlight?
It's Lena Dunham, a 30-year-old American actress who's best known right now for being the writer and star of the award-winning HBO TV series Girls. She's also a feminist and became a top Twitter world trend today for comments she made in a podcast that she hosted and posted on SoundCloud a week ago called Women of the Hour. In the podcast, she talks about abortion and recalls a conversation she had several years ago with a girl who asked her to join a project in which women share their stories of abortion. Dunham says she responded back then by saying she hadn't had an abortion and still hasn't done so today, but added, "I wish I had." Dunham says she wants to help fight the stigma around the abortion issue, but there have been quite a few women responding to her on Twitter today, basically accusing her of making light of what is a very painful choice that some have to deal with. Jim?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Thank you so much for telling us all about that, Michael. Great analysis. Follow Michael on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. I'm there at VOA Stevenson. And as always, we invite you to follow the International Edition stream that's found at VOA_IE. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia: Indonesia police arrest three over suspected suicide bomb plot. UN rights chief wants Duterte's murder claims investigated. Efforts underway to retrieve kidnapped ICRC official in Afghanistan. Japan's top court deals a blow to opponents of U.S. base on Okinawa. China's Xi Jinping seen as facing daunting challenges in 2017. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more at the voanews.com website, and check out our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. In Turkey, investigations are continuing into Monday's assassination of the Russian ambassador to that nation. Turkey's political leaders have pledged the killing will not undermine relations with Russia, with both sides committed to cooperating over the Syrian civil war. Dorian Jones has more from Istanbul.
A ceremony was held at Ankara's airport for assassinated Russian ambassador Andrei Karlov as his body was repatriated to Russia. The ambassador was shot dead by an off-duty Turkish policeman at an art exhibition. Turkish Prime Minister Binali Yildirim said Tuesday in Istanbul that bilateral relations will not be derailed.
Bu olay şüphesiz Türkiye ile Rusya arasındaki...
Yildirim said strong relations will continue. No one has the strength to destroy the relationship between the two countries, and they will continue to carry out every kind of effort to overcome instability in the region. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says Turkey is committed to finding those responsible and that his security forces will work closely with their Russian counterparts. Ankara has agreed to cooperate with a team of 18 Russian investigators who arrived Tuesday. Police have detained 7 people, most of whom are relatives of the 22-year-old gunman who was killed by security forces shortly after he fatally shot the ambassador. Turkish security forces have said they are investigating whether the killer was connected to Islamic cleric Fethullah Gülen, who lives in self-imposed exile in the United States. Gülen and his followers are blamed by Ankara for July's failed coup. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Thick smog continues to hang over much of northern China, choking residents and forcing authorities to restrict economic activity and issue a red alert. That's the highest level of China's four-tiered pollution warning system. Dozens of flights were canceled, traffic restricted, and operations cut back at power plants, factories, and construction sites. Tens of millions of people live in the area where, especially during the winter months, when coal-fired power plants are working hard, the pollution has reached 10 times what the World Health Organization, that is, considers safe. In 2014, China declared a war on pollution as a threat to its future development, and there's concern that many people are simply ignoring the restrictions. Richard Lloyd is trade and industry research manager with the group China Policy in Beijing, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty while the pollution is a hot topic on social media, he does not see any social unrest, at least in the Chinese capital.
People are used to this, they're aware of it, and they're aware that the government is making moves to alleviate it. So in Beijing, I would not expect any protests about the air pollution. In fact, Beijing has just recently released, in the middle of November, a new heavy air pollution emergency plan. This plan stipulates that from 15th of February next year, national 1 and 2 emission standard vehicles will not be allowed inside the 5th Ring Road in Beijing. And the national 6 diesel standard will be implemented in Beijing from the 1st of January 2017. I think that the majority of the population in Beijing is aware, they know that the government is aware of the problem and they know they are making moves to improve it. There wouldn't be enough will at the moment to have any kind of protest. Of course, also in Beijing, being such a politically sensitive city with the government seat right here, it would be very unlikely to have any protest on the street.
We should note that this is a phenomenon that's usually confined to the wintertime months.
Yes, it's certainly more common in winter than in summer. However, this year you will most likely see more red alerts than normal because the other major change in the new heavy air pollution action plan for Beijing is that they've changed the requirements for the red alert. So while previously the red alert could only be triggered by a predicted 72 hours of constant pollution above 300 AQI, now 96 hours above 200, 48 hours above 300, or 24 hours above 500. This change in standards means that it's much more likely to have red alerts than previously, even if actual air quality in general is getting better.
Richard Lloyd said pollution is right at the top of the government's reform agenda. Here in the United States, Congress is preparing to take up another debate on how to handle Americans' access to health care and whether or not to repeal President Obama's landmark health care legislation. VOA's Carol Pearson reports that lawmakers now have more specific information about Americans' health care needs.
Researchers have known for some time that those who can afford better health care are generally healthier than people who can't afford it. But now they know who is more likely to die from drug overdoses, who is more likely to die from diabetes or other chronic diseases, and where they live. Dr. Christopher Murray and others at the University of Washington reviewed the death certificates from more than 3,000 U.S. counties over 34 years, from 1980 to 2014.
We found that different causes matter more in different parts of the country. So out west, for example, in the U.S., violent death is more common, whereas heart disease is more common in the southeast, and deaths from drugs are much more common in West Virginia or Kentucky.
Heart disease is the leading cause of death overall in the U.S., but the risk of heart disease and other diseases and injuries differs significantly among communities, highlighting stark health disparities across the nation.
We really need to understand why there's such variation in how long people live and what causes children, adults, and older people to die at such different levels in different communities.
Each of the U.S. states is divided into counties with their own local governments. The researchers also found health differences between counties in the same state. What's more, the gaps in life expectancy from one county to another are increasing.
It's incredibly important for us to understand why different communities live very different lifespans. And the variation across the U.S. is enormous. You know, there's more than 20 years difference across communities, and we really need to understand that.
Murray and other researchers say their work could be used to address causes of death in particular areas and improve Americans' overall health. The studies were published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And now that you've heard the story, you can see it on our website at voanews.com. Be sure to check out the video for that and many other of our stories online. Also, follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE, and you can like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated 1/4 of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. 2/3 of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.
This is VOA's International Edition. Oh, it's that time of year again. Every Christmas, children around the world write letters to Santa Claus. But as Erica Celeste reports, while the missives never make it to the North Pole, or many of them don't, they do in fact reach Santa Claus, and they're answered.
The tiny town of Santa Claus, Indiana, may be 6,000 kilometers south of the North Pole, but the residents are some of Santa's best helpers. That's because every year they get nearly 25,000 letters for Old Saint Nick. And head elf Pat Cook says they answer every one of them.
From the earliest we know is that the postmaster started answering letters in 1914 that children wrote.
By 1930, the postmaster was overwhelmed. When Pat's father heard about that, he organized local veterans, the American Legion, area clergy, and the high school typing classes into the first volunteer letter-writing elves. Pat started helping just a decade later. These days, the elves send out one of four form letters that bear positive messages about sharing, being good, and helping others. But they also include a personal note.
We never promise anything, and we never admonish anybody. We just encourage.
Letters arrive year-round, but the bulk of them come in November and December. Chief male elf Ed Reinhardt believes there isn't a country they haven't heard from. And the U.S. Postal Service ensures that the letters get to Indiana no matter the address.
They come in the mail, and that's all they have on it, Santa. Some of them say Santa North Pole. Some of them say to the guy in the big red suit.
Other times, letters arrive from small children without a stamp or just a sticker in the corner. While they try to answer every letter, the elves are saddened when no return address is included. Their research team tries to track the letters by postmark zip code, but sometimes even that's not enough. So they encourage parents to always check for return addresses before letters are mailed. This year, Hatchimals, iPhones, puppies, and ponies are all big requests from children. But there are plenty of requests from adults, too. Young people in China asked to do well on exams or get into university.
We've had some adults that have asked for a diamond ring or a husband. We've had adults that have, you know, asked for healing.
On an average day, Reinhardt takes 1,000 letters to the post office, where he stamps them with a Santa Claus stamp, specially designed each year by a local high school student. The elves of Santa Claus never dreamed their good deeds would get so much attention. Despite suggestions that people pay for the letters from Santa, they hold firm to their commitment to continue the service for free.
Everything that happens, happens because there are good people who care about the real Christmas spirit and the real meaning of Christmas.
For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in Santa Claus, Indiana.
You can be sure we write to Santa Claus as well, and every year we ask for the same thing, just a little more airtime with you. We're out of airtime for the moment. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Be sure to follow us on Twitter as well. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jimmy Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thanks so much for spending part of your day with us, and have a wonderful day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From time to time, the United States identifies certain individuals as crucial to the operation of terrorist organizations. Most often, these are top leaders, or they help finance terrorist organizations. In all cases, these are people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. Such is the case with Abdullah Ahmed al-Mishadani, Abdelila Haimik, and Basil Hassan. All three are involved in the external operations of the foreign terrorist organization and specially designated global terrorist group ISIL, also known as Daesh. Iraqi national Abdullah Ahmed al-Mishadani works with foreign terrorist fighters who choose to join ISIL. He handles their accommodation and arranges transportation for suicide bombers. Abdelila Haimik, also known as Abu Suleiman al-Faransi, is a Moroccan-born senior foreign fighter for ISIL. In 2015, Haimik created the Tariq ibn Zayed Battalion, a foreign fighter cell composed primarily of Europeans. This group, which once numbered as many as 300, operates on behalf of ISIL and conducts attacks in Iraq, Syria, as well as outside of the Middle East. Basil Hassan is a Lebanon-born Dane who is an external operations plotter for ISIL. He is accused of an attempted assassination in 2013 of 70-year-old Danish author and journalist Lars Hedegaard. He was arrested in Turkey in 2014 but was later released, allegedly as part of an exchange for 49 hostages held by ISIL. Under Executive Order 13224, Abdullah Ahmed al-Mishadani, Abdelila Haimik, and Basil Hassan have been named by the U.S. Department of State as specially designated global terrorists, and their names have been placed on the specially designated terrorist list. This means that their assets within U.S. reach have been frozen, and they are locked out of the global financial network. No U.S. citizen or company may conduct business with them. In this way, the United States disrupts financial support networks for terrorists and terrorist organizations. By designating Abdullah Ahmed al-Masadani, Abdelilah Kaimik, and Basil Hassan as global terrorists, the United States hopes to hinder the deadly agenda of these terrorists.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.